Welcome back to our series In Conversation With. We're exploring the lives and careers of people across LGIM to understand more about what brought them to asset management. This podcast is intended for investment professionals.
This episode of LGIM Talks was recorded on the 18th of March. Any market data stated was correct at the time of recording.
Thank you for joining us for another LGIM Talks In Conversation With. I'm Eliza Grimmond, investment writer, and here to talk dark comedy, diversity, and defined contribution pensions is our head of DC at LGIM, Emma Douglas. Emma joined LGIM in 2014 from Mercer, where she was head of workplace savings. Prior to that, she worked at BlackRock and Threadneedle Investments and has more than 20 years asset management experience. She holds an MBA from Manchester Business School and is a non-executive director of the Pensions and Lifetime Savings Association, where she chairs the policy board. Emma, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you here.
And great to be here too, Eliza.
To begin, let's talk a little bit about what led you up to this point. What did you study at school and university?
Well, Eliza, like you, as I've now found out, I read history at Oxford, so it doesn't necessarily immediately lead on to a career in finance. But I do think that history is really at heart a study of people and their motivations. So what could be a better training for managing a large team of people?
Did you have your sights set on something else when you were a child?
And I suppose the thing I've always been really passionate about is theatre. So, you know, that's acting, but also producing and directing. So did a lot of that at school and at university. And I feel that a lot of the skills that you have, particularly when you're directing a play, is very similar to managing a team. You know, it's working with people and it's trying to bring the best out of them. So I actually think there are some analogies between the world of theatre and the world of finance.
Did you take that with you once you'd progressed into finance? Did you still dabble in acting? I mean, do you still dabble today?
I certainly did for a while. So, you know, with a friend of mine, we set up a theatre company and we produced shows. I directed some of them at the Edinburgh Fringe, also did a couple of shows at the New York Fringe as well. So, I mean, these were great fun days. And at one point, I had three shows on for a month at the Edinburgh Fringe. I was going up there every weekend to check on the shows, balancing that with my day job at the time. So it was a really, really busy period. And what I found was it's quite an all-consuming hobby. So if you're actually directing a play, you've got to be there. You know, if you're an actor, you might not be in certain scenes, you might not be called for every rehearsal, but as the director, you've got that overall vision and you really need to be there every rehearsal. So once my daughter was born, I've kind of stepped back from the theatre, but I do still keep a vicarious interest because my husband's a theatre producer and my daughter's very interested in theatre as well. So we're certainly a very theatre-focused household, though, of course, we always talk about pensions in the evening because it's so much more interesting.
I think that leads quite nicely onto my next question, which is how did you get your break in finance?
Well, I suppose like many of my peers, I kind of ended up in finance after university because, you know, our fabulous history degree sort of doesn't necessarily, you know, put you in any particular career path, but it doesn't close any off either. So, you know, so I was there very much a generalist in finance. Then I went and did an MBA at Manchester Business School because actually at that point I was seeing that if I did want to progress my career, you know, in a business context, it would probably help to have a little bit more of the necessary skills required. And that was a brilliant course. You know, it was like going back to university again, except you're a little bit older and you'd been in the world of work for a few years as well, so you could really appreciate the student lifestyle.
And bringing you back to the grounded world of DC, how did you move into DC?
Yeah, and I ended up in DC, really, because it was actually the very early days of DC when schemes were just starting up DC for new entrants. And I was hugely interested in the idea of DC because although investments is a really important part of DC, it's not the only bit of DC. You know, I always see it as a three-legged stool. You know, you've got to get the investments right, but you've also got to be able to communicate to members in an engaging way, and that really is quite difficult. And you've got to get the administration right as well. There's a lot of highly detailed member record keeping in DC, and you've got to get that right. Otherwise, the member feels the pain if you don't do that properly. So you've got to get all of those legs of the stool right. And increasingly now, I think there's a fourth leg, which is governance. You have you got the right oversight of everything that is going on within a DC scheme?
Just to pick you up on the member communication side, I know you have a young family, Emma. How would you explain what you do day to day to your friends and family, or indeed a member who might be part of one of the LGIM DC schemes, for example?
Sure. And I mean, people often don't ask me to explain anything further when I mention that I work in pensions. But, you know, even when they do, I mean, it's really about helping people to have a better life when they're older.
And how's your role here at LGIM taken shape from when you first arrived in 2014 to realising that tangible vision that you've just outlined?
Yeah, I mean, I've had a kind of really interesting career path at LGIM, Eliza. So when I started out, there was just me, and I was working in the solutions team, so, you know, within the investment area of LGIM. Then I moved across into distribution, and fairly soon after that, I actually took on the distribution side for not only our investment part of the business, but also our bundled part of the business where we do all the member record keeping. And then after that, I took on responsibility for the administration of all of the member records as well. So I've been a pretty great meteoric career trajectory as far as that goes.
It sounds like you've been quite active in all four parts of the DC business that you outlined earlier in the conversation. Which part do you enjoy the most, or indeed, which part of your overall role do you most enjoy?
I suppose there's three things that are my absolute top faves. So I really love pitching for new business. That is my absolute favourite thing. You know, it's meeting the clients, understanding what they're looking for, you know, being able to really work up a compelling story that will make them want to come and put their DC pension with Legal & General. That's my favourite. I'm sure that really annoys loads of my salespeople because I always want to do the pitches. I also really love public speaking, so whenever I get a chance to do that, I think that probably is a bit of the, you know, the theatre coming out in me, but I love doing that. And I think, you know, probably the biggest thing that I love, though, is seeing people succeed. So it's been absolutely fabulous to see, you know, my team grow. You know, we were just talking earlier, it's such a great team that I've got. And there's some very, very talented people in that team. And it's brilliant to see them develop and shine.
That's fantastic to hear, Emma. Now, taking a slightly more challenging perspective, what's been the most difficult thing that you've had to overcome in your career, and how have you dealt with it?
I mean, to be honest, Eliza, I think it is the current role. You know, what I really appreciate about my job at LGIM is that people gave me a challenge. You know, it was take on this business, change it and grow it. And really, it's trying to do those two things at the same time that is the big challenge. So you're a growth business, but you also need to make quite fundamental changes. And yet, at the moment, we've got our digital customer initiative, which is really transforming the way that, you know, we actually allow members to interact with us, giving them a much, much better user experience, but also how we're transforming the operations side of our business as well, you know, making it more efficient, enabling members to get their money quicker. You know, that's just so important. It's a fundamental thing. Lots of work going on that. And, you know, things like the use of robotics. You know, we're really embracing new tech in DC. So that's great. Trying to do that at the same time as growing a business. You know, so, you know, over the last 6 years, our total DC assets have grown from around 40 billion when I started to, you know, it's around 95 billion at the moment. So massive growth over that period as well. Yeah, exactly. So combining the two is a real challenge.
I'm getting a sense from you that what's really motivated you in your career is policy, developing tangible solutions for the end user at the end of the pension journey, and engagement. You chair the policy board at the Pensions and Savings Lifetimes Association, and I know that this is central to your role there. Can you tell me a little bit about the organisation? You mentioned it earlier, but I'd just like to know a bit more detail about what its focus is and how you contribute as the chair.
Absolutely. So, you know, PLSA is really, you know, the membership body for the pensions industry. And, you know, the aim is to get people a better outcome in retirement. So it's a lovely, simple aim. And the great thing about it is that on the policy board, this is a relatively new governance structure, but the policy board has been pulled together from all of the different representative bodies of the pensions industry, so DB, DC, local authority, master trusts, and we all sit around a table. It's quite a big policy board, so, you know, it's sometimes quite a challenge to chair because, as you'd expect, we've got a lot of people who've got a lot of ideas, but we actually debate as an industry group, and we've also got representatives who would cover some of the wider savings angles as well, where do we think policy needs to go? Where can we really make a difference? And it's all about the end saver. I mean, pensions is quite a complicated ecosystem. You know, you've got the end saver, you've got the employer, you've got their advisors, the consultants. So, you know, there's a lot of interest to take into account, but where we can, we're trying to come up with a unified policy line, as that will make it so much easier for us to put that forward to government and policymakers.
It's been nearly 8 years since auto-enrolment came into force, and we're starting to see the dust beginning to settle. How's it changed the picture for the retirement space, and what are your main takeaways now we've had quite a considerable amount of time to reflect?
I mean, honestly, Eliza, it's been such a massive game changer in the pensions industry. You know, we used to have to spend a lot of time getting people to join a pension scheme, whereas now they're joined automatically and they actually have to do something if they want to opt out. And, you know, thinking back to 2012, you know, and the earlier years when we were thinking about all of this policy, you know, people were really worried that opt-out rates would be incredibly high. You know, some thought they'd be as high as 60%, you know, and the industry consensus back in 2012 was that opt-out rates would be around 30%. They didn't think people would want to stay in a pension when they've been automatically joined. But that has not been the case. You know, our opt-out rates on average around 6%. So most people who join a pension stay in it and keep contributing. And keeping contributing is going to be the main reason that these people get a better outcome at retirement. So I'm so excited about that. And of course, the amount that's being contributed has crept up as well. So last April, we got to the 8%. And that's, you know, 3% employer, 5% employee, and they get some tax relief on that. But I think there's probably still more to go there. So, you know, one of the PLSA board's policy lines that I'm very much behind is we do need to get to 12% over time. And it would be great if we could equalise those contributions. So it's 6% employer, 6% employee. And then I think, you know, employees would think that's fair. They're putting in 6, but so is their employer. Now, when you do that, we would also need to think about a different range, maybe of opt-down or opt-out mechanisms, just because saving at that level won't necessarily be right for everyone, particularly at a lower income level. But for, you know, really a majority of the population, getting to that standard and building on the fantastic foundations that we've had from auto-enrolment would really be a significant game changer.
It certainly is encouraging that with each successive contributions hike, the opt-out rate underperforms expectations of what the industry is projecting.
Exactly. And, you know, Nest has done some really good research on that. And, you know, we talk to our employers quite a lot. And a lot of the feedback, both from the Nest research and talking to our employers, has been that actually most employees are quite happy that they're in a pension scheme. They knew that they needed to do something about it. Would they have gone and done it themselves? Would they have automatically increased their contributions themselves? No, they probably wouldn't. But as it's been done to them, they're actually quite happy to stick with it. So, you know, it's not just that they're in there and they're totally apathetic and they don't do anything. It's they're in and genuinely think, that's great. I'm glad this has been taken care of for me.
Thank you, Emma. I want to talk about another hot topic now, which is women and pensions. There's a lot of media speculation and attention over what's called the pensions gender gap. In 2019, you won a Women in Pensions Award for Lifetime Achievement. And as a high-profile woman in an industry which is only recently beginning to see strong female representation at the top, never mind the bottom, how has the landscape changed? In your opinion, what factors have helped you in your success?
I mean, for me, it's always having a really strong team around me that has really helped my success. So, you know, when I look at my management team, you know, it's 50-50, men and women. And below that layer as well, we're really encouraging of women to progress careers within pensions. I think it is actually an industry where, you know, we can offer a certain level of flexibility. A lot of my team work from home, you know, are agile workers. That can actually help if you're just trying to juggle a few extra things in your life, which often we are trying to do as women. And, you know, going back to what really motivates me at work, you know, it's seeing people succeed, you know, and there's some fabulous success stories in my team of, you know, of how women have really transformed their career, have lived up to their full potential. And that's vital. And we, you know, I think we all need to do our bit on that. And I see very much that's incumbent on me as a manager who has a very large team of people ultimately reporting into me, to really be seen to do my bit to make sure that talented women and, of course, talented men really get that chance to perform to their full potential.
And given that there is a lot of industry speculation on whether women are under-contributing to their pensions, do you think having more female representation can help to understand and maybe at least speak to and communicate with women who are affected by this gap?
Yeah, I think absolutely it's got to be a good thing. But, you know, I wouldn't necessarily go down the, you know, we need to have a pink website for women. You know, I think that's, you know, that's patronising. That's never mm-hmm. going to work. But maybe a little bit of having lived the experience of, you know, looking after kids, looking after aged parents, you know, some of the caring roles that have fallen more naturally to women can help a little bit when you're trying to get out the message to other women of, if you are going to do that, that's, you know, that's great, that's fine. But maybe there's a few things you need to think about around your pension contributions. Have that conversation with your partner, or think about saving up a little bit more in your 20s so that you can afford to take that career break in your 30s. You know, just some messages that maybe come better from someone who's lived it rather than someone who hasn't. But, you know, I don't think just women have to communicate to women. I don't think that makes sense at all.
Of course, but it's great to see an example at the top. And you mentioned you have a young daughter earlier on in the podcast. Does she have a pension already, or at least a junior ISA?
Well, absolutely she has a pension. Yes, very much so. So she's had a pension pretty much since she was born. So what we're hoping is to prove that urban myth that if you put in the $3,600, on which you get basic rate tax relief, every year until your child is 18... that should sort them out for life. So, you know, I'll be long gone by the time Tara gets to 55 and she can access that pension. But, you know, I think it's actually a great way.
Hopefully not.
Well, I think it's quite likely statistically. You know, I'm not an actuary, but I wouldn't say that I'd be around at that point. But, you know, I really hate the thought of mummy worked in pensions and I didn't even get one. So she's definitely got a pension.
I'm sure she'll be extremely grateful for that. And finally, a question I always love to ask. What can we expect to see in the DC landscape in 2020 and beyond? What's exciting at the moment, and what would you change?
So I think we are going to see a super tech storm hit the DC industry. So we've probably been lagging a lot of other industries in our adoption of tech, but things like the pensions dashboard, you know, it needs to come. Members need to see all of their pots in one place. You know, there's quite a lot of great modelling tools out there, you know, and ones that link to PLSAs, you know, retirement living standards. But unless you can put all of your different pension pots together, your future is always going to look grim. If you just look at one pot at a time, you know, it's like a series of grim outcomes. Put it all together and actually you've got a real chance of seeing that, yes, I can have a decent life in retirement. So that sort of ability to consolidate or view everything in one place is vital. It'll be tech enabled. The tech behind it, I think, is actually relatively straightforward, but there's a lot of data challenges out there. I wouldn't want to underestimate that, you know, and particularly in defined benefit world, where actually you'll find there's quite a lot of paper files stored at Iron Mountain. You know, that's not the most digital thing that you could come across. So getting that kind of data online and accessible to the end member, I think that's going to be really, really important. We're also going to see the absolute revolution of the post-retirement world as well. So, you know, Freedom and Choice came in 2015. We've seen a lot of people access their pension at 55, you know, to take a bit of cash. What we haven't really seen is people doing income drawdown seriously. And I think that's partly just a generational thing. People who are retiring now, their DC pots are relatively small in general. So a lot of those are going out as cash. But over time, more and more people will be investing for much longer.
And how about your future, Emma? Any plans to take the stage by storm?
Well, I don't have any acting or directing gigs booked up just at the moment, Eliza, but I certainly do want to, you know, keep talking at conferences and appearing on pension stages, if not theatre stages.
I believe you were quite a fetching ghost at the recent LGIM DBDC conference.
Well, absolutely. I can't stop doing a little bit of acting at these things. I think everyone would really want me to stop, but I just can't stop it. So I had a particularly great ghost noise as well that I know you liked.
Do you want to give me a rerun?
Woo! It's pretty scary, isn't it?
We'll be profiling more employees from across the business in the coming months. If you've enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave the podcast a rating and subscribe to LGIM Talks or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.